The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning, or whatever time of day it is for you. And I thought we would continue on with the general wander through the Satipatthana that I understand Andrea has been doing for quite a while. And she told me that you are now in the fourth foundation of mindfulness. And so I wanted to talk about a particular area that appears in this fourth foundation. There's so much in that last, maybe I should call them establishments, that last establishment of mindfulness, because it really is about watching the unfolding of experience to reveal patterns in the mind, and particularly patterns that lead toward and away from suffering. So these kind of come to a head in the final contemplation of the fourth establishment, which is about the Four Noble Truths. So I hope you'll forgive me that you're not going exactly in order of all these practices. But this fourth establishment in particular is really about a wisdom perspective on experience. It's very compatible with the receptive awareness practice. So we notice the qualities of the mind that are contributing to the increase and decrease of dukkha. And we also notice how the mind is when it's free of dukkha. So I'll focus on the first of the Four Noble Truths, which is the truth of dukkha. And having practiced through all of these various establishments up to now, you might understand then that mindfulness of dukkha is actually a fairly subtle and nuanced practice. It's not just the same as noticing what's painful, although it includes that, you know, in body or in emotions. But there's actually maybe different layers to it that can be discovered if we keep observing this quality that's called dukkha. So, recognizing the kind of challenges of the human mind and body as this more impersonal quality called dukkha is to take a wisdom perspective. Dukkha is deeper than my problems or even my suffering. It's just suffering, just dukkha. So if we allow our receptive awareness to open up to what is called suffering or dukkha, if we touch it repeatedly in different ways, we will start to appreciate that dukkha is quite multidimensional, and our understanding of it becomes more subtle as we observe it more and more in practice. And this is really, in a sense, the beauty and the wonder of Buddhist practice, is to turn toward something that is dukkha, something that is causing tension or suffering or stress or unreliability in our experience, and have an idea that by understanding that, we might find some release. So the First Noble Truth says simply that there is dukkha in life, and the associated task, according to the first sermon that the Buddha taught, is that we are to understand dukkha. We are to develop some understanding of what this is. There's a nice quote in one of Anālio's, Venerable Anālio's book. He's quoting actually Rupert Gethin, who's a scholar. And the quote is, "Developing an understanding of the First Noble Truth involves not so much the revelation that dukkha exists as the realization of what dukkha is." So I don't think anyone has too much trouble understanding that there is dukkha. Does anybody not know that there's some kind of difficulty or suffering to involved with being a human? So that's not quite what was meant by understanding dukkha. So that there's the revelation that it exists. Maybe some people need that. But then we need to understand a little bit more fully what is really meant by that, what it really is. What is dukkha? So let's talk a little bit more about some of the ways that we can come to understand or experience this quality of dukkha. And I will broadly go from grosser to subtler, but the order may not be exact. There are things, I'm sure there are things that I won't have time to cover today. So, you know, consider it just kind of a broad survey that might be resonant with some of what you've observed, and see how that is. So the first understanding of dukkha that we can bring is dukkha as pain. Often when we arrive in practice, we have a very personal sense of our dukkha. We're there because we have some kind of pain. We have a pain of illness or of injury or of aging or difficulty in a relationship or a life situation of losing our job or something. We might be struggling with mental states that are difficult, like depression or sorrow or other things that are quite easy to label as suffering. It's not hard to understand those particular things as suffering. And this is dukkha. You know, this is often our first encounter with it. It might even be what brings us to practice. So some people have even said that they feel like Buddhism is a particularly respectful religion because it acknowledges right up front and affirms that, yes, the human condition is challenging. There isn't an idea that it's wrong that this is happening. It's like, no, the Buddha said, actually, this is what happens when you're a human. This is it. And so there's a certain amount of respect in that when you arrive. And often our first sense of this dukkha is that it's individual and personal. And we would tend to, for example, attribute the cause of it to something external. It's those people or that person or that situation is making me be this way, is bringing this on, is causing this to happen to me. Sometimes people come to practice out of a strong sense of the dukkha of others. That's also the case. You know, the suffering of the world or some world situation can be very distressing. But again, there's the common theme that often the source of that is seen as something external. So we can watch as we start developing a more receptive and awareness of how the mind is operating. We can see the mind relating to this pain by creating a story like that. And as we, you know, as we respond to this kind of dukkha in our life, we don't only have to just sit and passively watch it. It's a good approach to make some changes when we have this kind of pain, this top level kind of dukkha. So we generally would put more wholesome conditions in place in our life. We might change jobs or change friends or change our work situation to be more supportive of our health, maybe work fewer hours or take a less stressful position, or, you know, we make these adjustments which are healthy responses to this sense of dukkha in our life, this sense of personal challenge that we might arrive with. And we'll do that throughout the path. You know, our life keeps changing, difficult situations happen. It's very important to learn to make healthy adjustments to those in our conditions of our life. And then also internally, as we practice meditation, we tend to calm down a bit and we tend to feel less tense physically and gains greater access to our awareness. When I began practice, my body was literally very tense. That had been my habitual reaction to the stresses in my life, was to build up tension in my body. And I actually spent a number of years at the beginning of my practice consciously relaxing my body and balancing my posture. I was amazed at how I was willing to sit in postures that were out of balance or tense, or that when I was in contact with surfaces like the seat I was sitting on, or if I had my hands against a table while I was working, that I would build up tension against those surfaces, and I would somehow resist the touch of the surface. It was just a habit, but I had to see that, and I learned to relax slowly. And we start to experience some of that as we practice. And then internally also, we may have instances where we notice that we are able to be patient instead of angry, for example. So this sort of initial outright dukkha, if you will, that's not a technical term, but I think the Buddha called it dukkha-dukkha, the dukkha of inherently painful things, it begins to lessen a little bit as we practice. So these are kind of normal things that we would do at the beginning of practice. And they're also essentially the aims of Western psychology, is that we create circumstances externally and internally that are wholesome, supportive, nourishing, that lead to resilience in the mind. And generally, we want to get ourselves into life situations that are functional and more happy than we had before. However, I've set that up carefully to say that Buddhism has the potential to go a little bit farther than this. In a sense, we are asked to look, to continue looking at this quality of dukkha. To some degree, all these efforts are rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, that there's more fundamental issues at work than dukkha as pain. But it turns out that as we address this top-level pain, the general state of well-being, or the increased well-being that we get from that, is one of the conditions for seeing more subtle forms of dukkha. So we can start to, we might remember, for example, that the Buddha himself led a relatively sheltered and pleasant life for conditions at the time, but he felt some dissatisfaction, didn't he? It wasn't really enough for him that he had a nice house and good relationships and enough sensual pleasures that he wasn't in pain all the time, and a good enough position in society that he didn't feel oppressed. All of that was in place for him, but he felt a fundamental agitation and dissatisfaction with it. He sensed intuitively that that is not actually the point of human life, to get those things. So if we stay with this receptive awareness and are open to the possibility of seeing more dukkha, we can learn more about this important quality. So as we continue to watch the mind and body, the flow of experience, we see that things keep changing. Actually, we can't hold on to our good mind states or life situations. Have you noticed? So we have a deepening understanding that experiences are not completely controllable or even repeatable, and that pleasant experiences do eventually change and end. Of course, unpleasant experiences change and end also. So, we might still have a sense that much of this is happening to us due to external conditions, but we can maybe get a glimpse of a dimension that's a little bit more universal. As we see how it works in our life, we see it's not actually just personal. All humans are subject to these changing circumstances, the vicissitudes of a life, and they're reacting in various ways. We may start to realize that the problems of the world largely stem from this reactivity that we see. The Buddha said that we have a dart embedded in our heart, It's a very kind of visceral image for me. And, you know, there's something actually, like, imagine when you, have you ever walked around with a splinter in your foot, something in your shoe for a while, and you couldn't stop where you, at the exact moment you were, and so you had this splinter sticking into your foot step after step, and there's a tendency to want to kind of run from it, but you can't because it's in your foot. And so there's a sense that there's a dart embedded in our heart, and that is contributing to this dukkha, this continual sense of dissatisfaction. So we have a kind of an inability to grasp happiness in worldly conditions. So we start to realize that there's this sense of unsatisfactoriness or unreliability that pervades life. And we start to see that it's our own mind or heart that plays a role in our happiness. So maybe we move away from a town. Let's say we're having difficulties where we're living. And so we do the first, we address the first kind of dukkha by moving to a new town. We get a new job. And it's better. You know, it's better, the situation that we've created. But we discover that we've taken our mind with us. We've taken our mind with us to the new place. And so, you know, there things are supportive, but we notice that that pattern of anger or a pattern of depression or something will creep back in certain ways. We start to see the same patterns happening. Sometimes this can be a little bit discouraging, but it doesn't have to be, because we see also that the happiness that we can create through this also follows us and has a way of growing through mindfulness. We start to see, if we're doing awareness practice, that the special quality of bringing awareness to our experience has a way of increasing wholesome states and decreasing unwholesome ones. So there's something about happiness is going to be an inside job, in a sense. And so we have our initial techniques that work pretty well, and we start to see the beginnings of a path through this dukkha that we couldn't see before when we were only focused on the external dimensions, only focused on trying to rearrange the deck chairs. So we do enough of that that we start to see, oh wait, there's a path inside that can start to unfold. And it has to do somehow with working with these inherently changing conditions in our mind and our life. This is the beginning of real wisdom, actually. And there's kind of common sense wisdom of getting into better life situations. And then we start to have some Dharma wisdom about the changing nature of experience and the way that our mind and heart play a big role in our own happiness and some of our dukkha. So we might be encouraged then to continue with this practice, continue with meditation in our life, maybe start to even do some retreats or opportunities to practice more deeply, or maybe do one of those daily life retreats where morning and evening there are supportive conditions to check in, and then we are watching our mind all throughout the day in between. These are really great trainings. We're starting to see these more subtle dimensions of dukkha operating. So as we start to have more wholesome states in the mind, more instances of being in a non-reactive state, more instances of continual mindfulness for a stretch, or if we develop some degree of samadhi or some of the brahmaviharas, really any of the wholesome states of mind, then if we do vipassana meditation of looking at the changing nature of experience from this kind of wholesome mind state, we start to see more clearly how our mental patterns are operating. This is what I pointed to a little bit toward the end of the meditation. We start to see patterns that are kind of general, like a pattern of self coming in. Oh, this, something happens and we habitually think about what that means for me or what that says about me. You know, my partner said something to me this morning. What does that say about me? It's just a habit, but we notice that pattern happening repeatedly, or we notice particular ways that we react, like, you know, a certain person may trigger us repeatedly. And we just notice that pattern. We notice that certain words are upsetting to us, maybe because of something earlier or because of what they represent in our mind. And, you know, we just start to see, okay, these are the kind of ways that my mind tends to flow along with experience, how it reacts to various inputs. And so we start to see that there's a little bit of dukkha that is actually kind of built into the system. Despite our intentions of wanting non-suffering, there are forces in the mind that keep us enacting what we now know brings suffering, which is greed, hatred, and delusion. We see again and again that these are operating in the mind. So I mentioned also this, I alluded to this pattern of self. The formation of ourself as a separate entity is something that can be seen. It's almost like I once saw like the mind kind of as a body of water, like a lake. And often the surface is meditation can be relatively calm and flat. And then there's a way in which the self is like a form rising up out of the water, a shape being constructed from this otherwise flat surface of the mind. And it's very interesting and attractive. You know, the attention immediately is going to go to the part of the water that's rising up above the surface. So that's, you know, kind of the way the self attracts attention, if you will. So we start to see that particular patterns have a particular kind of stress with them. The self has this flavor, anger has that flavor, wanting has a certain kind of tightness to it. And it can be very helpful to get familiar with the flavor, if you will, of the different kinds of dukkha that come in. And then it can be that we start to get the sense that everything, actually, all of these patterns of the mind have this kind of dukkha built in. This is called the subtlest form of dukkha, sankhara dukkha. The constructions of the mind, any kind of construction, comes with a little bit of stress. Anytime that we've separated something out, that we've intended something, that we've created something, we've built something, that process has a little bit of tightness to it. Life has some tension to it. This is not at all discouraging, by the way, but it does lead to the realization that sankhara dukkha in particular doesn't have a solution in the conditioned world. We can't create better conditions such that conditions are not oppressive. Conditions themselves are oppressive, if you will. So that is an opening for the mind to look for the end of dukkha. Wholesome karma is a wonderful thing. Wholesome creations are important, and they are what allow the mind to see more and more deeply. And then in the end, something else will happen for this final form of the stress of creation. So these are some of the layers of understanding that can evolve around this quality of dukkha. If you will, it's the path of understanding dukkha. So the fourth noble truth applied to the first noble truth. And this is, I want to return to the Satipatthana Sutta. Now in the fourth foundation, fourth establishment of mindfulness, it says very simply that this is all we need to do is watch the way the mind is operating with this particular lens. It says, how does a meditator abide contemplating mind objects as mind objects? That's the Dhammas, this last foundation, in terms of the Four Noble Truths. Here a meditator understands, as it actually is, this is suffering, or the text actually says this is dukkha. They understand as it actually is. This is the arising of dukkha. They understand as it actually is. This is the cessation of dukkha. And they understand as it actually is. This is the way leading to the cessation of dukkha. So there's nothing philosophical to contemplate. It says this. This is dukkha. That means this experience. Oh, this is dukkha. It can be quite a revelation to realize that we're not looking for something abstract. We're looking, we're experiencing this moment and noticing, is this dukkha that's happening? Is this dukkha right now? Or is this perhaps something that's related to the arising of dukkha? Are we seeing the grasping that is concomitant with the arising of stress? Or is the mind currently not really experiencing dukkha? This is the cessation. This right now, this is dukkha ceasing. It's releasing, it's relaxing. Attention is going away, or anger is subsiding, or I've seen through the self, that delusion, that bubble of delusion has been burst. This moment, this is the cessation of dukkha. This is what it's like. Or this is one of the qualities of the path. You know, the mind has patience right now. The mind has metta right now. These are qualities that lead to the end of dukkha. These wholesome mind states contribute to a mind that will be able to release. So that simple lens of understanding can be part of receptive awareness practice, to look for or notice those particular patterns in experience. And the Buddha says this is a good idea. This is a good way to take the whole mass of mind and body experience that we have and place some order on it, such that the mind develops toward the end of suffering, toward awakening. So these are some reflections on this quality of dukkha, which is not at all bad news when it's taken in the light of practice like this. It's actually the beginning of the good news to see dukkha, to see our challenges in this way that is ennobling of the heart. That's what makes them noble truths, is when we see them in this light. So I hope this has offered some, maybe some possibilities for how you might explore these very beautiful and fundamental teachings that the Buddha offered on dukkha and its release. Yeah, so I'll stop there, and we'll have a chance for some reflection together, some